Hello, this is Vershawn Young, host of New Books in African American Studies, the interview series where authors of African American life, arts, culture, and sciences discuss their new books. Today, I'll be speaking with Jafari S. Allen, assistant professor of African American Studies and Anthropology at Yale University and author of the provocative new ethnography, Venceremos, The Erotics of Black Self-Making in Cuba, published by Duke University Press this year, 2011. I'm sure you'll enjoy this lively interview and enjoy reading the book. Listen in. Hello, Jafari.
Hi, Vershawn. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for asking. Today, we're speaking with Jafari S. Allen, assistant professor of African American Studies and Anthropology at Yale University, and author of a meticulously researched and exquisitely theorized ethnography that we're featuring today. It's called Venceremos, The Erotics of Black Self-Making in Cuba. It's published by Duke University Press in 2011. Venceremos, Allen explains in the opening pages, is a political expression, meaning we shall overcome. This certainly resonates with the Black U.S. experience in the Civil Rights Movement and, if we think about it, contemporary politics with such slogans as, yes, we can. Allen, however, mines the politics or interstitial terrain of gender, class, and sexuality, which makes this book a quite provocative read. I've read it and I recommend it to all of our listeners. So we're happy to have Jafari with us today. Jafari, would you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, first, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for your very kind introduction. As you mentioned, I teach in the departments of African American Studies and Anthropology at Yale, and I'm also a faculty at the Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies and Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Trans Studies here at Yale, and those sort of locations really, I think, express who I am intellectually and where this book comes in. That is, that it is interdisciplinary and it is grounded in Black feminist and critical race theory, but also, as you mentioned, it is an ethnography, a critical ethnography. And so here I'm really concerned about expressing some of what I experienced on the ground with my respondents and friends in Cuba over the many years that I researched in Santiago and mostly in Havana, Cuba.
Mm-hmm. So how did you come to write this book? How did this project come to you?
Well, this is a huge revision of my dissertation. And my dissertation was an exploration of Black masculinity in Cuba, or I should say Black masculinities in Cuba. My first idea for a dissertation project was comparative masculinities between Brazil, Cuba, and the U.S. And my advisor, Sherry Ortner, was smart enough to tell me the first week of graduate school that I ought to just pick one. And by that time, I had already spent the summer in Cuba doing a language program and had fallen in love with Cuba. And so the book comes out of going back to Cuba to re-engage my respondents and to think again about how masculinity intersected with, articulated to larger things going on in Cuba. And I learned during my dissertation defense that, you know, what the dissertation was really about or what the book should be about. And so I really owe a great deal of thanks to Robin Kelly and Stephen Gregory and Sherry Ortner and Nadine Fernandez and Carol Vance for telling me what the book was about. And I remember specifically Stephen saying that this book is about the special period. And the special period in times of peace, of course, is that period in Cuban history right after the fall of the Soviet Union, in which there were tremendous economic difficulties, but also, as I argue in the book, there were tremendous sort of moral and effectual and all sorts of other changes on the ground that my respondents were going through in very small ways that I attended to in my research for this book. And so that's the, you know, the recent history of the book, but it's a deeper history really, and goes back to my upbringing with a father who was always always concerned to tell me about the fact that there are black people all over the world, and that we ought to be concerned with and connected to those people all over the world. And he was especially interested in Cuba, as were a lot of black people of his generation, because of the claims that Fidel Castro and the revolution had made about sort of solving the problem of racism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so Cuba represents, for many black people and for many people who consider themselves or their groups downtrodden or oppressed by, for example, the U.S. state or multinational corporations, et cetera, represents opposition. And I was fascinated by Cuba because of hearing stories from my father from when I was very young.
Mm-hmm. Before we get into talking about the particular chapters in the book, I want to spend a little bit more time talking about some of the things that you open up so beautifully in the introduction, the way in which there's a set of contradictions about freedoms in Cuba that some black people experienced, but yet also held back. I mean, the very title, Vincent Amos sort of alludes to that, that still struggle. But I want to throw two other things out here right away, that the set of contradictions and what that might yield for or help explain in a U.S. context as well.
Hmm.
And then the other thing is that you're pushing a certain kind of boundary throughout this book when you talk about gender, when you privilege gender. You do talk about sexuality, that becomes very clear. But in the beginning of the book, you state a reason why you foreground gender, and you say that it is the failure to perform the strict scripts, in this case, masculinity,
right,
and the attributes and rights that is itself classed and raced. And so that's pushing the boundaries, I think, of sexuality studies and queer studies. A little bit, which you also talk about. So, can you respond to those two things?
Yeah, I'm glad that those things come out at least for you in the introduction, because it really does. I'm really trying to set for the reader what my intentions are and where I'm coming from here, and I think that it may be. One can say that it's pushing the boundaries to say, to sort of, I don't know whether I privilege gender, but to talk about how important gender is even when we think about sexuality. It's really perhaps a feminist sensibility that insists on, or I would say a black feminist sensibility that insists on looking at the intersections of these positions.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it is perhaps controversial in sexuality studies. Many many sexuality scholars or scholars of sexualities want to bracket sexuality as a separate, discrete category of experience. Yet, as an ethnographer first, I have to recognize that what my respondents experienced and what I saw was something that requires an end both and requires a sort of wait, let's look more closely at what's happening on the ground before we move to the space of bracketing sexuality in that way. And that is, and I argue in the book, that while this notion of homophobia means one thing in a U.S. context, or while, for example, we find that let me back up here and talk about the law of dangerousness, and I think I talk about that later in the book,
mm-hmm.
And about these sort of public performances mm-hmm. of gender, right? So while we find this in various places in the Caribbean, for example, buggery laws or laws outlawing homosex in various English-speaking islands, and for example, in the Dominican Republic and in Cuba, homosex is not outlawed. And what I heard from my respondents was that it's pretty well understood that boys experiment sexually with boys or have sex with boys. One of my respondents joked that everyone on his block played sex when they were young, and he just never grew out of it. But when he told me that story, what he was recounting for me was the ways in which having sex with men was not the scandal. The scandal was walking out in the street and walking in a way where somebody might call you a maricón, a fag,
mm-hmm.
or mm-hmm. sitting in a way that was not appropriate,
mm-hmm.
or having a voice so high, or not being manly in various ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue that even in the context of the U.S., that is also something that we have to pay close attention to, that what in many cases what we are talking about in terms of the scandal of sexuality is really the scandal of the scandal of gender performance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you know, transgender study scholars are beginning to show us this in really important and startling ways. But we need look no further than the sort of the everyday examples of gay and lesbian culture and people in popular culture,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
To see that this move toward normalcy, sort of a gay man or a lesbian who looks just like you and I, who acts just like you and I, who just wants to get married just like you and I and have a white picket fence just like you and I. So it's again about a particular sort of normalcy,
mm-hmm.
That is not so much imagining what people are doing in the bedroom,
mm-hmm.
or the living room or the kitchen, right?
Mm-hmm. I appreciated that point in the book for slightly selfish reasons, probably because I didn't tell you in our pre-interview conversation that I'm working on a manuscript in which your manuscript, your book, helped illuminate some ideas for me. And the title of it is Straight Black Queers, Gender mm-hmm. Anxiety and the American Dream. And just as an aside, in relation to what you were just saying, what I'm trying to do is shift the boundaries to pay attention to this very phenomenon by looking at ostensibly straight individuals who are read as gay, like Barack Obama, for instance, or Tyler Perry, and what that means for the larger context of compulsory heterosexuality or compulsory homosexuality when it's raced. This brings me to a question for you about something that you make very explicit, and you say that that race impacts the categories of gender and sexuality in Absolutely. Very particular ways. Can you say more about that and how that informs the theorizing in the book?
Right. Like, one of the things, just in your case and in your book talking about the U.S., it's important to think about what is it that makes these straight or ostensibly straight individuals seem kind of gay. Right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in my experience in the U.S., because I haven't done this research, but of course we can see it through literature and film and everyday life, that it has a lot to do with class, the way someone speaks, etc. Right, so that if you're called soft, right, soft means, what does soft mean? Soft means that you speak in standard American English.
Mm-hmm.
Soft means that you stand in a particular way. You know, we know from Bourdieu that there are these notions of bodily hexis, the way that someone, or habitus, the way that someone walks into a room, the way that someone sits, the way that someone looks at another person. All of this is being read. All of this information is coming at the same time,
mm-hmm.
right? And so we can't separate race from gender from sexuality, what we think of sexuality when we see someone when they walk in the room. And in Cuba, this happens as well. So my last visit to Cuba last November, while I was on leave, I was there for an extended visit. And I saw a friend who I hadn't seen in maybe 2 years, and he immediately said, "Ay, negron is a word that is not just negro, right? It is a big black man."
Mm-hmm.
And he said that to signify the fact that I had gained several pounds since the last time we saw each other, but that notion of negron, of a big black man, comes with a number of sexualized and historical with historical and sexual valence.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So to say big black man is not to say big black man who studies anthropology. Right. Big black man comes with other sorts of things that everyone in the room understood.
Mm-hmm.
When he said that, right? Mm-hmm. And so to be read through a history of being sexual chattel, of being an unpaid worker, of being history of being disallowed from participating in higher education, right? A history of African religion that mm-hmm. is embodied and that is scary perhaps to those who are uninitiated. All of this goes into the way that people are read as sexual beings and as intellectual beings and as revolutionaries, right? And so one of the main questions for my respondents who are now in their 70s, I mentioned that one of the hard parts for people who were young at the moment of the triumph of the revolution
mm-hmm.
in 1959 is how to be a revolutionary, how to be a new man, that new man being an atheist, and that new man being disciplined, and that new man being someone who is going to defend the nation, and also later on, maybe toward the 70s, with the advent of the family code and understandings of gender that sought to supplant a particular form of what people thought of as machismo, how to be a new man in terms of being an equitable partner with women.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you do that if the image, if the controlling image of blackness is one of someone who is insolent, who is out dancing or in ceremony for hours, or someone who is whose body is represented as always having sex or working.
Those same set of questions seem to come up when we think about the latter part of the civil rights movement, and particularly, you know, the Black Power and Black Arts movement in the U.S.
Absolutely.
Are there resonances?
There are absolutely resonances here, and this is why, you know, I think of my work as a, even though it is based in Cuba, and this is a work about Cuba, it is just as much a diasporic work because there are resonances all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the resonances is the image, and Robin Kelly does a great job of talking about this in Race Rebels, of course, that during the latter part of the civil rights movement, the strategy was to show clean, unsexed, Christian, upstanding black
mm-hmm,
people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, I often, you know, ask my students, you know, what, show them pictures of these beautiful upstanding black people on protesting, you know, women in hats and white gloves and
mm-hmm,
pumps,
mm-hmm.
walking for miles on mm-hmm. you know, on the Pettus Bridge, wearing a black suit and black suit and black tie, shine shoes, to face dogs. What work does that do? The work that it does and the work that it did was to present an uber respectable subject. How can you deny rights to these respectable, upstanding subjects?
Mm-hmm.
We are not the partying juke joint, unemployed, bad black people, or colored people, or whatever word that they might use that you might imagine. We are upstanding Christians demanding our rights to this piece of the American pie.
Mm-hmm.
Right? One of the things that Robin points out, though, is that at the same time, there were people who were too tired from being at the juke joint all night to get up and put on a dress and a hat to go. And they had other ways of resisting.
Right.
Right. Which don't always get publicized,
mm-hmm.
which his work and then the work of Kathy Cohen, of course, tries to push us in the direction of looking at what people who are not the ideal subjects of the ideal subjects for rights, what they were doing and how they resist. And this is some of what I try to do in my work also.
Yes, I was just getting ready to say that, because that comes through exceedingly clear. That and I'm going to try to summarize it, and you correct me after I do this reduction. It seems that some performances and some profiles are aligned with a set of privileges that were opened up for Afro-Cubans during a certain period of time. But then there were other hidden or subjugated performances, which I'm going to call queer after your use of the term, which is connected to, but also in some ways enlarged from, sexuality. I think you have a footnote to this regard. And that now seeking a larger freedom, to reference another of your terms, means looking at these and subjugated positionalities and seeing how they challenge the hegemony that's still in place.
Mm-hmm. Right. This is one of the, you know, and that larger freedom I borrowed from Kofi Annan. And the reason I use that term is that it seemed to me, listening to my respondents and watching what was happening in the moment and reading back through through Cuban history, is that at this moment, Cubans, of course, enjoy free education, postgraduate education from preschool to postgraduate. They enjoy healthcare. They enjoy a lot of things that many people around the world would really want. Now, the contradiction, we talked about contradictions before, is that there are tremendous limits placed on each of these. Since the special period. My colleague Sean Brotherton writes about the medical establishment in Cuba, and one of the things that is very easy to see, for example, and you know, I saw this up close going to doctor's appointments with some of my respondents and friends, is that even though the ratio of doctors to patients in Cuba is 20-1, which is the best ratio anywhere in the Americas. Once you get there, it's likely that there won't be adequate medicine for you. And if you go down the road to a hospital where foreigners, including people from the U.S., are going for cutting edge treatments for cancer, for example, those places are really very well outfitted. And so again, you know, here we're back to the contradiction that you mentioned earlier. But in terms of a larger freedom, what my respondents seem to be looking for and asking for is not only the economic rights that Cubans have and the social rights that North Americans are seen to enjoy, that is freedom of expression and freedom of association, you know, to join groups, have organizations, to say whatever you want in any medium you like. They want both, and they want this full expression of their humanity, which is something that we see in Marx and Engels, for example. And we also see in the liberal philosophies of the United States, and even before that in Locke and Rousseau, et cetera, right? Mm-hmm. So it is not a matter of what people can sometimes simplistically see as a communist or a capitalist sort of dichotomy. People are saying in this current moment that there's no reason that it can't be an and both situation. And so theoretically, this and both is you know, very related for me to Black feminism, which comes at a time or emerges at a time in the late 70s and early 80s in which the movements of the U.S., movements that is Black Power movements, civil rights movements, the women's liberation movement, seemed to be at that time either winding down or in serious trouble or had already failed. And so this was a moment in which these theorists and artists and activists imagine something more than what was being offered. Mm-hmm. And here again, we go back to my title, Venceremos. That Venceremos for Cubans is expressed with an exclamation point always. Mm-hmm. Venceremos, we will win, we will overcome, right? And at this point, there is a serious question about how we'll overcome or whether we will even overcome. And so in sort of playing with Spanish grammar and punctuation, my title has both an exclamation point in the front, as is the standard, but at the end there is a question mark.
Mm-hmm.
That is, that there's this "and both," that the vision for a larger freedom says, yes, we must win. That is, we, because winning means full recognition of humanity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the question mark says, question mark questions how this will work,
mm-hmm.
right? And this title for me, even though, you know, it's always a point of discussion, which I think is great. But I always think back to Audre Lorde's the end of her Age, Race, Class, and Sex, Women Redefining Difference.
Mm-hmm.
When I think of this "and both" in this question, and that is when she says, we're at the edge of each other's battles, and if we lose, someday women's blood will congeal upon a dead planet, right? So that question of losing, if we don't win, that's not a... For my respondents and friends in Cuba, that's not a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
That is, this losing means going back to the bad old days, means not having this recognition of full humanity. But the real venceremos, the real we will win, goes back to the end of this piece, where she says, if we win, there's no telling. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So we don't mm-hmm. really know what that looks like. We seek beyond history, she says, for a new and more possible meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Which seems to me to really resonate with revolutionary rhetorics in Cuba and the work of Cuban poets like Nancy Morejon and Nicolas Guillen, and the work of hip hop performance artists like Las Cruas, right? Who are envisioning something that that Fidel et al. Did not imagine. That is something beyond that, which I think, you know, if I could sit and talk to Fidel and Raul, et cetera, that they would agree that that's part of the revolutionary struggle, is that at some point the vision becomes wider.
Mm-hmm. What is, for you, the primary point or set of points that you want readers to get from your book?
That's the gotcha question, right? That's the question that that should have been really glaringly obvious in the introduction that I don't think I made glaringly obvious. I think that that there are a couple, and they're on a couple of levels. One is on a sort of an academic, scholarly level, and I think that I have a section that I call sort of scholarly minefields in the introduction that talks about the fact that in order to do this work, I've had to see it now. It's called scholarly crossroads and political minefields. So. One of the interventions is around interdisciplinary scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
And this book tries to make interventions in a lot of scholarly fields. And I used to joke with people that this book would piss off just about everybody, right? Because on some levels, it says to Latin Americanists, look, you've not considered blackness in Latin America adequately. And of course, this is, you know, with exception to the fabulous work that has come out very recently, but still under theorized, still this reproduction of a mestizo subject constantly in this work, and also looking to Cuban studies to say that there is a world to discover beyond the sort of facile arguments about whether Fidel is or is not the devil, or whether or not Cuba has cured racism, right?
Mm-hmm.
That there that there's a lot more to discover, and that we ought to engage this in a really serious way, without these sort of skirmishes between on either sides of the Florida Straits. And to say to Black Studies, following a lot of important folks who've done work in Black queer studies, that one of the key ways to continue and expand the project of Black Studies, Diaspora Studies, African American Studies, Africana Studies, however they want to configure this, is to take seriously categories of deviance that include queerness, that include people who are not the sort of ideal de-sexed, clean, respectable subjects, right? Mm-hmm. And this is an argument, of course, that Kathy Cohen has made in her Deviance as Resistance. But I want to push this forward here in this way. And another one is around the import of looking really closely at what Black resistance is. What does it mean to resist? And what are the various forms of this? Right? Lots of scholars have done work on this in a theoretical way, but I'd like to push and invite us to do more work on this with on the ground research to see what people are doing in their daily lives. And then another one of the interventions, I think, is also about re-examining in anthropology, for example, re-examining the gifts, right, that were brought to anthropology in the 80s. That is around reflexive work, around work that insists that we not write ethnographies as if we are flies on the wall, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. omniscient seers, right? That work that does not center the author, but that lets the reader see perhaps ways in which the author is complicit in meaning making on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And for following the decolonizing anthropology move. And Decolonizing Anthropology is a very important collection edited by anthropologist Faye Harrison that pushed us also to recognize the ways in which Black anthropologists have a very particular and important role to play in the new anthropology. And one of the things that I argue in this book, it's not explicitly argued, but I think it's argued through the way that I write the ethnography, is that there's no way that I could have had access to the places and people that I had access to and the stories and the feeling that we created together if I were, sort of differently configured. Mm-hmm. Right? All mm-hmm. of us as ethnographers, we do our work with our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so if we want to know, if we want to know something, then it's important that we send a variety of people with a variety of experiences and ways of experiencing what happens on the ground, who are recognized by people on the ground in various ways.
Mm-hmm.
Right. One of the things in terms of Latin American work on sexuality in Latin America that I discovered that I don't write in the book, which is sort of I think perhaps implicit and between the lines, is that being a 20-something Black man, a gay Black man among 20-something gay Black and other men in Cuba meant that I had access to spaces and people and conversations that I would not have today, for example, even, a couple of years, I won't tell, mm-hmm. How terribly old I am, but a couple of years after, right?
Mm-hmm.
And certainly different from the experience of a 24-year-old or 27-year-old Black man in Cuba talking about sex to another 20-something-year-old black man is very different from having a 50-year-old white man who lives in a beautiful apartment somewhere on the other side of town talking to, for example, sex workers about sex work.
And of course, in your monograph, it isn't only men that you describe and talk about. You do talk about women as well.
Yes, one of the things it was very important to me in terms of doing the new research for the book outside of the dissertation to go back and talk to more of the women that I had developed relationships with, and to have the book be about women and women with women and women with men and men with men and men with women and mm-hmm. various recombinant groups of that. And so I do try to give a broad sort of view of what's happening on the ground with these groups of people that I'm dealing with. And this is, you know, there's one of the chapters in which I talk about these nascent parties of women's parties is that I was my access to that party was facilitated by my friendship with lesbians.
Mm-hmm.
And the party that I talk about specifically in the book is one in which I was one of maybe three men with, I don't know, maybe 60 women or more at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but at the same time, if for example, a colleague who is also a woman or who is also a lesbian might have a very different, or certainly will have a very different entree to that scene.
Mm-hmm. And since we've crept into the particularities. Would you mind reading a passage for us?
Yeah, actually, I'll read that piece about the party, and the section is named after. There are throughout the book sort of references to the music of that moment that we were listening to, and which, you know, I continue to listen to. And so this section is called "Yo no me parezco a nadie," which is "Unlike No Other," which is a song by a popular Chilanga timba band called Bambaleo. I had never before been to this section of Havana, which sits just beyond Miramar, where avenues widen and homes seem no worse for the revolutionary wear. The collective taxi I was riding in with Yanides stopped a few blocks away from her friend Marilisa's home, and we carefully extricated ourselves from the crowded Chevy, full of Cubans on their way to visit family members or to do other business on this late Sunday afternoon. I had thought of splurging on a tourist taxi since my first trip to the women's party was a special occasion, but Yanides usually preferred to use peso-friendly Cuban transportation, even though it was often slow and always crowded. In any case, it was much cheaper to ride in the collective taxi, where we listened to the hushed conversations and occasional raucous, entertaining banter, especially on longer trips or when the driver was feeling particularly gregarious. I kept my comments to a minimum, since after all, I was passing as Cuban. Yanides and her friends agreed that rolling up in a taxi was not very respectful of Marilisa, since the interest of her neighbors would certainly be piqued by a number of taxis arriving on a late Sunday afternoon. To be discreet, therefore, my crew thought it would be best to walk the last few blocks to her place. Still, I wondered what the neighbors would think of the fact that they had not been invited to the party and that all but a few of the guests were women. This party, 5 years before the advent of the popular Fiesta de Lila and Milagros, or the Fiesta de Humo, or the Fiesta de Barbura, seems now, years later, to have been a kind of dry run for the women's parties that have become very popular. Indeed, they have even undercut the popularity of the men's parties, since they are often closer to the city and therefore more economical for Cubans to attend. Of course, like the 20 peso parties, the venue changes each time, with those in the know using a telephone number circulated among friends in order to get the address. We ascended the stairs to be greeted by a striking woman whose long fitted dress and short cropped hair made me think of Vanya from the Tinder band Bambaleo. As we entered the room, Isaac Delgado's El Plegón de Chocolate was blasting from one small floor speaker, and the dance floor was alive. Five or six couples were twirling, undulating, and laughing. Some sang along with the coro, Tengo el chocolate para ti. At the center of the floor, a circle of women had captured everyone's attention with their hip shakes and shudders. The gorgeous Vanya lookalike at the door was Marilisa's girlfriend of the moment, and it was she who had organized the event and now collected the entry fee and warmly greeted everyone at the door. Somewhere between what people were used to seeing as feminine and what they expect of butch, she stood, confidently, apparently taking particular joy in multitasking. She sang the coro to the song, shifted her shoulders, shook and rolled her hips, folded the money, smiled, and chatted up the guests. In that two-story home on the outskirts of Havana, in this room with stripped floors and very little furniture, we witnessed the party alive and pulsing with loud music, good food, and beautiful black women in various combinations of dress, complexions, hairstyles, and economic backgrounds. Like were rules in Cuba for women's party wear, some wore it in bandeau tops with high-waisted shorts, jeans, or short skirts, and others in chists that grazed or passionately embraced their bodies. But most, no matter what the style, wore it as if it were makeup, an application of color over the skin. It served as more than mere covering or clothing. Flowered polyester or even cotton chists and sleeveless shirts were worn by the more modest, with a leotard or tights underneath. At this party, distinctions between butch and femme seemed less apparent at first, at least to me, than those between class groups. Of course, I was far from the intended audience of the women present. Still, the women drinking beer out of bottles and cans, talking the most and the loudest, and wearing pants, collared shirts, and sneakers, Oxford shoes, or hiking boots, made their butch presence felt. A few could afford to accessorize liberally, and others, like the vast majority of Cubans, had to keep a basic repertoire of one pair of shoes for going out, and something to wear for every day, and one good outfit for very special parties and other occasions, which is handled with great care. One partygoer told me that it would therefore be foolish for a woman, no matter how butch she was, to use her meager resources to buy things that she would wear only to these parties. The fiesta seemed to intensify when the DJ played Yo no me parezco a nadie, unlike no other. The title is more than apt. Here at the party, a long woman with long curly hair and small stud earrings pulls another party guest onto the dance floor, and the two of them get their life. The first woman's footwork, stomping each step in her rounded toe hiking boots, and her manner of staring off seriously into the distance as she leads and spins her partner, betrays the flirty femme shirt she wears, tellingly worn oversized and buttoned over a tight leotard-like t-shirt. For her part, the other woman moves wherever her partner will have her move, smiling and laughing as the vueltas get faster and change direction. First three to the left, then four to the right, to the side, then under the arm, a move that was pulled off elegantly even though the dance lead was a few inches shorter than her partner. As the typical timber break comes, all horns blaring and piano banging at the same time, until the timbales and clave change beat again, the long-haired woman lets go of her partner's hand to step up close to her. She shudder shakes as the other woman rolls her waist with her hands on her hips, moving up and down with her legs astride, toes nearly on point in the flowered Chinese slippers that were so popular then. Rounded toe boots are planted firmly, shoulder length apart. As Vanya sings the command, Entonces empújalo, so push it, arms go up and fists are shoulder height. The long-haired woman's shoulders are stiff, as her chest, stomach, and ass shake and shudder powerfully. The coro begins, hi-hats strike, and her partner holds on, closer. Slowing her balletic grind in halftime of the clave, she is syncopated with the piano. The party goes up. A room full of women swoon. Finally, a smile comes from the long-haired mulatta who has seemingly commanded this so well. She is obviously enthralled by the graceful femme. She's got her now, my friend Demora says. Pretty flowered slippers, perfectly positioned for plié, The fen rolls up to her partner's betrayed, delicate blouse, down those loose-fitting jeans, putting her hands tentatively on her partner's thighs, then up again, lets them rest on her shoulders and whispers something in her studded ear. The music continues and they move steadily. Step, stomp, one, two, three. Turn, roll, four, five, six. The stomping woman tucks in her blouse cum jersey and rolls the cap sleeves into her undershirt. Smile, three, four, stomp, step, one, two, turn. The new intimate friend of the now tucked woman takes her partner's long curly hair, smooths it, and ties it in a makeshift bun at the nape of her neck. Aye, my friend Dolores says, rapidly snapping her fingers in the air. Imagínate eso, es así. Imagine that, it's like that. And everyone in our corner, standing close to the DJ, changing a stack of burned or pirated CDs on a makeshift table, giggles. Perhaps as a joke, the DJ switches unceremoniously to Los Bambas, Este te pone la cabeza mala, this'll make your head bad, it'll make you crazy. And then the redressed dancer laughs innocently. We finally see her teeth as she opens her mouth wide, then a bit shy, whispers something to a partner, and takes her off to a corner where they stayed for much of the night between repeat performances. Dance is serious play. Cubans take learning how to dance and express oneself with another person on the dance floor as an important matter, though many of my respondents would disagree that it is learned at all. The courting dance at this party, a sort of butch femme pas de deux, did not go unnoticed by the admiring crowd. The initial and apparent success of the dance floor icebreaker challenged and emboldened other women in the room, some who looked butch and others who did not. Some led, some followed, and others did neither. Sitting there in a suburb of Havana, watching and trying to be unassuming, mostly unsuccessfully, as one of only a few men and one of the people entranced by the ballet to which we were treated, I thought of Audrey and Africati in a brick frame house in Queens.
Hmm.
Quote, dancing with her, I felt who I was and where my body was going, and that feeling was more important to me than any lead or follow.
Hmm.
In making friends in spaces like this one in the life, sweat pouring, horns blaring, and bodies moving, one can begin to melt away the thick carapace of learned alienation from our desires and from each other. It is a catalyst for the creation of community.
Very beautiful. You know, you have the craft of a novelist.
Well, thank you. That really means a lot to me. And I think one of the points that I'm trying to make. I don't know that I'm trying to make the point, but just doing my work with the voices and the training that I've received, this is very important. That is that, you know, when I'm writing and when I'm thinking, the theorists that I'm responding to are Audre Lorde and Toni Morrison, mm-hmm, and Tony Caden-Bara and James Baldwin and Marlon Riggs, mm-hmm, and Sylvester, you know, and Larry Levan. That is that the theorists that I'm referring to are not all those that are approved in the academy, but these are the people who have, I think, most incisively theorized these moments of becoming, mm-hmm, or who have shown us how specifically Black people and queer people and poor people have become and are in this movement. And a lot of this comes from poetry and from creative writing. I mean, mm-hmm, the people that I talk to, you know, on a daily basis are people like Marvin K. White, who is for me the inheritor of the mantle that Essex Hemphill left for us, right? T.R.E. Jones, who is a friend from way back when we were at Spelman. I said that again, we were at Spelman. I was at Morehouse, not at Spelman, even though I did try to transfer, and Dr. Cole was not having that. But that is that, you know, this is, I think, it's an ethnography, it's a book, mm-hmm, of anthropology, but this,
yes,
is an African-Americanist work. And as African Americanists, we are grounded in this discipline that tacks back and forth between uh, between disciplines.
Yes.
And between forms. And, you know, one of the highest compliments that I can get is to be told that there's that you can hear some of that in there, right? That you can hear the fact that I'm reading Ordre de l'Ordre, and this piece is very much an homage to the beginning of to the Africaine portion of her Zami.
Mm-hmm.
And there
mm-hmm.
are other pieces where you'll hear where I have shamelessly I've shamelessly not ripped off because it is attributed, but shamelessly copied my friend Sharon Bridgeforth.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's in there because it has to be. Right?
Yeah, you use the one of the phrases when she says a whole lot of shit is liable to happen.
Yeah, and that is, you know, Sharon and I had a long discussion about that because of this moment of how do we theorize these spaces in the life that are not only theoretical spaces or spiritual, but literal places where people end up
mm-hmm.
that are queer.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes back to this notion of queer and queer straight, that queer can be, that is, the juke joint, this place that she imagines in her work, is a place where there is sexual intrigue with people who are gendered variously and may have sex with people in various recombinant groups of who's having sex with whom, depending upon, and she says, there are men's, women's,
mm-hmm.
some who are both
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
some who are neither.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That for me is an incisive theoretical statement.
Right.
Right. And this is a space, she says, where a whole lot of shit is liable to happen.
Yeah.
That is, that this is a space of people who have been hurt and disallowed, for whom there is no real home, and they're making their home in places where there's liquor and there's music and there is a feeling of at least momentary belonging, conditional belonging, right? And these are spaces also where there's a lot of perhaps illegal stuff happening, and even some illegal stuff for even the way people are dressed, right? And we could think of times in the U.S., for example, when or even Stonewall, right? In New York in the 60s and 70s and before, you had to be wearing at least three pieces of attire appropriate to your assigned sex.
Hmm.
Right. And so the spaces where someone who is different, who is a gender insurgent, goes is automatically a space of illegality just because of the way that they're dressed.
Right.
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 So a whole lot of shit is liable to happen. The police are liable to come. Or this is a place where the police may not come if something goes on and you actually need them.
Right.
And we don't have, you know, those of us who are working on Black queer studies have begun to do this work to investigate this. But looking at, you know, our predecessors, the people who have done this work are poets and novelists and activists and filmmakers and visual artists.
Right. You know, we're running out of time, and there's so many more questions that I have for you. We're just going to have to have a time where I just call you up and chat, just
let's
chat
do
with
that.
You. I wanted to ask and get you to talk about one of the most fascinating subjects in the book, for me at least, which was Octavio.
Octavio, yes.
And his female name, Lily?
Lily. Mm-hmm.
Lily, yeah, that is very fascinating, and the relationship, you know, in the community and how that gets played out, especially when he comes out, so to speak, with
mm-hmm.
the dress on the street. But since the cover is the first thing that readers encounter, can you tell us about this really rich picture on the front cover? It's, I mean, it's completely fascinating.
Absolutely. You know, the adage is that you can't judge a book by its cover, but I really wouldn't mind. I really would not mind at all if people judge this book by this gorgeous cover by my friend Renee Pena.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say that this is, I say in the acknowledgments that it was a dream come true. In 1998, my first trip to Cuba in 1998, I went to to visit the Ludwig Foundation, which is one of the very few, at that point, the only independent gallery on the island. And I saw a show with Rene Pena, and this photograph was there. He's one of the most important contemporary Cuban artists, and most of his photographs, he stages his own body. And so that's Rene Pena in costume in the shot.
Okay.
And I think that looking at this photo and sort of meditating on it from 1998 really influenced me in a number of ways. And, you know, Rene and I have not talked very much about his intention, and I think that that's probably good because, you know, I like my my reading of this, that he's sitting there in sort of white face, sort of blue face,
mm-hmm.
And he's sitting with a cup of tea and in a pose that I would describe as slightly effeminate or mm-hmm. effeminate, and he's gazing on a table where there are tarot cards and regular playing cards, a teacup, a sort of apothecary or a sort of chemistry type beaker with some mysterious thing in it, a couple light bulbs, chicken eggshells, and pearls. And so that is one of the things that I saw this is sort of reflecting on a lot of are left with after the revolution and after the special period and after the rectification movement and after independence and after slavery. That is, there are a number of these elements that are on the table that they can use to figure out, to divine their future, how
nice.
We're going to win, what the future is. And that's what I see. That's what I see on this cover is, I'm thinking of that figure as a representative of all of my respondents, queer in various ways,
mm-hmm.
Calmly and elegantly, perhaps looking down and to see, how we will win, where this larger freedom is going to come from.
Mm-hmm.
And beside that, I just think it's gorgeous, and that's that is a reason in itself, in my book.
I would completely concur.
Yeah.
So tell us what you're working on now.
Well, what am I working on now? I'm looking at my desk now, and it tells it tells the story of what I'm working on now. The major project that I'm working on now is a new book project, which right now I'm calling Black Queer Here and There, and that has and the subtitle is Movement and Sociality in the Americas, and that has two parts. And one part, I'm doing case studies of activist organizations dealing with sexual orientation discrimination in the Caribbean. And in another part of the book, I'm talking about travel, one chapter on upper middle class Black men in tourism, another one on how the Black body is framed in pornography and in pornography and in legitimate art by and representing queer Black people, and another piece that is around how migration and travel is imagined in the works of Black queer writers and activists and artists. And so it's been a really fantastic beginning to this research to have spent time in the past couple of years in Barbados and Guyana and Brazil, and also in the book. It says in the Americas, but also in London, and doing some archival work at the Schomburg also. And so it's right now in formation. But the questions that I'm looking to answer is what difference, for example, queerness makes or blackness makes in these struggles, if any, and how at play black queer people, what we can learn from travel and tourism, for example, what we can learn when we look at people who move back and forward between spaces in black diaspora instead of merely looking at one space.
Mm-hmm. When those book projects come out, I hope to have you back on the show.
I would
discuss
I would love
those. Well, thank you, Jafari Allen, for discussing Vincent Amos, The Erotics of Black Self-Making in Cuba, published by Duke University Press. And have a good day.
Thank you so much. Take care.
I hope you enjoyed our discussion today with Jafari S. Allen, the author of Vincent Amos, The Erotics of Black Self-Making in Cuba, published by Duke University Press in 2011. What I personally gleaned from this lively and personable interchange with Jafari is that blackness is not merely located in the U.S., that it is diasporic and global, and that there is a connection among black politics around the world, and that we should pay keen attention to it. So I hope that you will go out and get Vincent Amos, read it, teach it if you're a professor, and share it with your friends.